In October last year, about 7 million people demonstrated against Donald Trump across America. Their rallying cry, "No kings." The president's response? A 19-second video of him at the controls of a military jet wearing a crown and dumping shit on demonstrators. Great torrents of brown shit to the sound of Kenny Logan's classic song, "Danger Zone." That's what's called a meme. Formal definition? A piece of media, typically an image, video, or text, usually humorous or sarcastic, that spreads rapidly across the internet. The other day, Trump posted a meme of the Obamas as dancing apes in the jungle. That didn't go down well with Trump's critics. Perhaps it went down really well with his supporters. The meme is now a crucial tool of government. Charlie Wazell wrote the other day in The Atlantic, "The US government is concerned first and foremost with spectacle, engaging in both fan service for its most extreme supporters and the constant trolling of its enemies. The goal, above all else, is to elicit a response." Charlie is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins me now. Charlie, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
You have been analysing, reporting, immersed in the internet for what, 10 years now? How are you going? Have you survived?
Oh, it's a nightmare on your mental health. it can be. It's obviously not war correspondence or anything, but I think a lot of people who did this started out because the internet was a curiosity. It was a fun, interesting thing. I always liken it to, or I used to liken it to, this like black box, right? Where you pipe in anything, politics, culture, media, and then whatever comes out on the other side is sort of like, has the, you know, the funhouse mirror effect. It's just weirdened in some way. And what's happened inside that black box of the internet it's of a darker and darker variety these days, right? So the thing that, you know, the curio that you pipe in there, it comes out as a neo-Nazi now. And that is, that can be a little hard to look at for a while, but it certainly is. I would say that internet culture has really become like the dominant culture, especially in the United States, in American politics.
Because that's where the audience is. That's where the voters are now.
It is. It's also, I think, like what you said about memes. It is just it's not only where the audience is. It's a very, very easy way to gain and gather attention. It's sort of it's the lowest amount of effort that you can put in, while also reaching the largest amount of people. Right. And these memes, this like artificial intelligence slop, whatever, it's very effective propaganda. And there are so many different broadcast channels and ways to get at and reach people. And I think attention is really power nowadays in our attention economy that we have here. And the politicians have realized it, and no one better than Donald Trump.
Do you kind of grudgingly admire Trump for making memes that send himself up? She really, really send himself up, like, you know, being a golden statue on the shores of the Mediterranean in Gaza, sends himself up in this way in order to kind of humiliate his critics, to show that he's kind of invulnerable.
I wouldn't say I admire. I think, first off, I don't think he makes any of these things. He's a prolific retweeter, reposter, especially on his social network, Truth Social. And honestly, I don't think most people have done this. You should go check it out. There's a website, actually, that you don't have to go to Truth Social. It's called Trump's Truth. If you go in there, and it aggregates all his posts, the things that he reposts, he will sometimes repost 60 things in a given evening, like all throughout the night, like wild, crazy stuff that you can't even imagine.
Do you think it's him doing it?
That stuff, I think, late at night, in the middle of the night, it is. But, you know, it's there's been evidence that, you know, some of his posts are drafted now. And a lot of the, you know, Donald Trump himself is not extremely online beyond, you know, looking at Truth Social now, or it used to be Twitter. He is not someone who, he famously like didn't really do email. He printed everything out. So I wouldn't say that he is a savvy internet user. What I would say though is that he has an extremely intuitive sense of attention and how to hijack it and how to stay not only just stay in the news, but also, you know, he realized very early on, I think, that shamelessness is a superpower in today's media ecosystem and especially on the internet. And I think he realized that if he just did the most outrageous thing, the news media, the rest of the, you know, politicians, the entire world basically has to react to him. It keeps him in the limelight. And it's an incredibly effective thing. He's short-circuited the news media for over a decade now, and it still doesn't really know how to respond to him.
Mm. But you are on the case, and that is what matters here.
Well, then we're really screwed.
No. I won't have any doubts about your powers, Charlie. Charlie, the memes that are coming out of the White House, there are the funny ones. And there are also, as you write in The Atlantic, there is just these serious nuggets, little bits of footage, little bits of information, which are fed out to the public. But hasn't this always happened? I mean, haven't governments always been in the business of feeding the media, feeding the public footage, information about what they're up to? That's old, isn't it?
Oh, it's definitely old. I would say that this administration, though, goes orders of magnitude beyond what any other administration did. I mean, if you just look at, let's just take their social media accounts on Elon Musk's X, formerly Twitter. The ways that the, you know, the government was messaging from, let's say, like the White House account, right? The ways that they would message is very, very anodyne, very almost, you know, like corporate-y. They're, you know, putting out their press releases. They're, you know, showing like the Bidens or the Obamas, you know, at the Easter egg roll at the White House, waving to kids. It's very inoffensive. It's very diplomatic. It's very serious. It's very of the office, right?
You write buttoned up.
Buttoned up, right. And what you get from the Trump administration, especially this second time, is he has very clearly, and I don't know who these people are because we can't really get to the bottom of that at the moment, but the people that are put in charge of this account are absolutely fluent in the edgelord online message board fever swamps, the places like 4chan that have, you know, all this racist, misogynist, white nationalist, you know, dog whistling. All of that ethos is being used in this account. It is the audience that the White House is trying to speak to. It's not just trying to speak to MAGA supporters. It's trying to speak to the extremely online, already like mobilized and radicalized people. And there's a message there. There's a secondary message, and it's sort of the medium is the message, right? Because it's coming, whatever they're saying, coming from the White House account, and because it's so unhinged, because it is a white nationalist or racist dog whistle, it's basically saying there are no adults in the room. We are in charge. And, you know, like, there are no rules. There's no more gatekeepers anymore.
You write in The Atlantic magazine about the way in which the memes worked after the seizing of Nicolas Maduro. Now, let's go through that, because I wonder again whether that is different from the ordinary operation of a government feeding the media footage, flattering footage of a government operation.
Well, I think one thing that was different is that they were doing it, they were monitoring in real time what the response was to their raid inside the quote-unquote war room there at Mar-a-Lago, right? This is a room, I'm pretty sure it was a skiff, which is like, you know, a room that is sealed off essentially, so that communications are as covert and secret as possible. They're conducting a military operation with the United States Army, and they have Twitter up on the screen behind them. They're monitoring tweets.
And what's the Twitter search? And what do you think the Twitter search is up on that screen?
It seemed to be, I think one of them at least was Venezuela. Like, that's just what they were searching.
Well, you know, Charlie, it's an advantage to know what country you're raiding.
It's very true. But what they were clearly trying to do, and you see this, you know, there was an example in the New York Times. They did a story about FBI Director Kash Patel in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination back in September. And he was dispatched with a number of people, you know, to the crime scene in Utah. And he was most interested in what was going on Twitter, on X. He was most interested in the reaction and whether people were saying good things about what was going on, you know, about the FBI's investigation, or whether they were, you know, getting dragged by different people for not doing enough. There was this constant obsession with their outside perception. And that's what's going on here, right? They want to see their supporters cheering it on. They want to see how this is being viewed. They view this through the lens. They view this, put it this way, the same way that an online creator, that an influencer, that a YouTuber, whatever, is constantly looking at their metrics, right? I made this post. Did it get enough likes? Is it converting audience members? This is an administration that, when you look at it, is made up of reality television stars, podcasters, Fox News hosts. These are entertainers. These are people who are very, very interested in that perception. They're very good at wielding that power and getting that attention, but they're horrible at governing. Like, absolutely horrible, because they don't care. That's not what they're in it for, first and foremost. And I would say that really is different. And if you look at, in the Venezuela example, if you look at the kind of stuff that they were putting out, I mean, they themselves were tweeting memes. And that's not like an update on what we were doing on the military, you know, raid. This was not something that was extremely helpful for people. This was just gloating and bragging in a moment of, I mean, honestly, like, intense geopolitical conflict.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Charlie Worzel about the power of memes in American politics right now. Charlie, after Minneapolis, or during the killings in Minneapolis, there were other content providers, weren't there? Citizens, dozens and dozens of citizens filming and posting what was going on. How did the battle between the memers of ICE and the public play out here? Who won?
Oh, well, you know, it's honestly still ongoing in Minneapolis, but I would say that the citizens of the Twin Cities did something pretty remarkable, which is they were able to not only mobilize and band together, you know, in their neighborhoods and protest the ICE raids and the incursion in the city, but they did an excellent job at documenting all of this stuff, of putting it out there, not even really editorializing too much about it, but just simply showing what is happening. I mean, if you look at any news photograph taken by like a photojournalist, you will see in any protest clash situation, not just people yelling or chanting, but people who are just standing there holding their phones, these observers. Alex Preddy, the ICU nurse who was shot and killed by ICE agents, he was filming. He was one of those people who was an observer during this protest, and he was trying to help an older woman, and you know, he ended up getting shot. But immediately after he was shot, administration officials, including Stephen Miller, who's the deputy chief of staff at the White House, you know, tried to smear him.
Yeah, they made up a absolutely false accusations about him.
Try to smear him as a domestic terrorist or whatnot.
Holding a gun in his hand.
That's right. And it turns out he was just holding a phone. I mean, you shudder to think what they would have said if there wasn't all that video footage. Because, you know, and so the way that I look at it is those citizens, I mean, Alex Brady died doing this. Those citizens took their life in their own hands, in their own city, to document this. And as a result, I mean, after Preddy's death, this story broke through to regular Americans in a way that very little has since the George Floyd killings in 2020. This was a moment of real reckoning, of real pushback against the administration. And it was solely because there were so many different angles that showed in these multiple, you know, violent encounters that resulted in people dying.
Yep.
That they were it was excessive force. You couldn't argue with that.
How effective do you think countering the memers of the White House have been those that have set out to absolutely ridicule Trump and his administration? And I'm particularly thinking of the efforts of the South Park team. Those memes are raging around the internet. People are busting themselves with laughter over them. How effective are they as a counterattack?
I think culturally it is very effective to attack, you know, to attack the administration, or, you know, basically give it its own medicine. I'd put it that way, right? A dose of its own medicine. I think it's when it comes from a cultural institution like South Park, right? That is just, you know, it's been going on for well over 20 years. It says something, and it's the right messenger in some ways for that. I think one thing that we have seen in American politics is Gavin Newsom, who's the governor of California, who a lot of people think might run for president. He has been basically parroting Donald Trump back at Donald Trump on places like Twitter and on all other social media platforms in order to make fun of him, to sort of show people how ridiculous the Trump administration and Trump's behavior is. That has I don't know how much that works, but when it's coming from satirists, when it's coming from people like that, I do think it is effective because, you know, the one thing that the Trump administration I think really is vulnerable in is they aren't serious. And when people attack them on that front, that they are, you know, that this is a government that's in some senses run by podcasters, you know, that kind of hits them where it hurts. But the last thing I'll say about this is doing stuff online, posting online, sharing the memes and stuff, it only goes so far. What we saw in Minneapolis, the reason why that was such an effective template is you have people who are posting things online, who are countering, who are documenting, who are, you know, have this presence showing an injustice to the world. And it is paired with this offline mobilization, this offline action. There were people in the streets. And I think that you have to marry both of those things as a political movement in the United States. You can't just have it all be online.
Is another problem, and you've in this unique situation of sort of looking down right over the whole internet, is another problem that the jokes of South Park are never going to be fed to Trump followers who are thrilled by the capture of Maduro?
You see, I think they do get fed. I think that filter bubbles, and this is why I think the cultural element of, you know, mockery or satirizing is really important, and South Park being a cultural institution, a sensitivity of the right wing is that, an insecurity rather of the right wing, is that they feel like they do not own the culture, right? The popular culture. They've always, you know, obsessed over Hollywood because they say it's, you know, captured by liberal elites, et cetera, right?
Yep.
They used to feel this way about Silicon Valley, but Silicon Valley has had a pretty massive rightward swing. But when institutions like, say, South Park, or, you know, when people speak out against ICE at the Grammys or, you know, the Oscars or some of these things, it really gets under their skin. The Super Bowl halftime show, which was, you know, all in Spanish this year when Bad Bunny performed, very clearly enraged these people on the right, because it pokes at this insecurity, at this vulnerability that they do not have. That, you know, they may control almost every branch of government exclusively in the United States. They have this, you know, Trump has this vice grip on our attention. And yet he does not have real control over the culture in that way. So I think it really needles them. And I think that's it, it gets to them and like they see it through the filter bubbles.
When you look to the future, do you take heart from simply the power of humor, the power of jokes, the power of mockery?
Oh, it's tough because I see something I'm thinking a lot about these days is there's a real, a lot of online humor has become extremely, you know, irony poisoned, but also very nihilistic in form. I think if you look at there, you know, a lot of the online reaction to the Epstein files is to create a whole bunch of memes and AI slop videos about that, or the same thing with, you know, Charlie Kirk's likeness after he was assassinated. And, you know, sometimes this starts out in protest, or this starts out as a way to memorialize someone or a way to sort of make light of a serious situation. And it becomes so ingrained in the culture, so absurdist and so abstracted that, you know, you have a lot of people now online like photoshopping themselves into photos from the Epstein files as a joke in order to promote, you know, whatever it is they're trying to sell you. And I think in that sense, that's pretty grim, because we're losing the plot on some of these things that are really serious. Now, in another sense, I think, you know, the internet is this really chaotic place that, you know, no one controls. It's given so many different people this ability to, you know, hijack attention and culture. And you can do that in non-destructive ways, right? Like you can do that. A funny countercultural person can break through and can try to, you know, crack the facade of this, you know, authoritarian leaning government that we have. So I think that there is real power in it, but I just hope that, you know, we don't, especially because American politics is so dysfunctional and there's so many people who, you know, for young people, Donald Trump is the only real major politician that they've ever known. I mean, you know, like he has dominated American politics for the last 11 years. And there are people who are so disillusioned that they go online and they just make light of all of it, because, you know, it's hard for them to think that anything matters. So it's the balance between the two and not falling into nihilism and using those tools. I think that's going to be like an essential struggle going forward.
Charlie, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Charlie Worsall, who is a technology and culture writer for The Atlantic and the host of his new podcast, Galaxy Brain. This is Late Night Live.